again, she also had this feeling that was more to be said, more to be explored. And the next meeting occurred 2 weeks later. And we've been meeting quite regularly since then.
Pat, it's been an extraordinary journey. And me and you have become good friends over this last number of years. And it's always good to have you here. I want to thank you, OK? I want to thank Michelle. And you're welcome back on any time. It'd be great to see you again.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Michelle.
Thanks, William.
This week we take a look at Bloody Sunday and the reverberations that followed for many years after. How has the city of Derry moved on from then, or can it ever fully?
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
New figures showed company insolvencies in Britain soared last year as businesses struggled with inflation crisis and the long-term impact of the COVID pandemic. We've taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, more than 47,000 British companies are on the brink of collapse after a 25% jump in the number of businesses facing critical financial distress in the final 3 months of 2023. The latest red flag report by insolvency specialist Begbie's Trainer found it marks the second consecutive quarter-on-quarter period when critical financial distress has risen by 25%. The construction and property sectors accounted for 30% of all businesses facing critical financial distress. The quarterly rate of increase in the number of companies facing critical financial distress grew by 32.6% in the construction industry, by 41.3% in the healthcare and education industry, and a quarter in real estate and property services, and 24% in the support services. 18 of the 22 sectors covered by the report recorded double-digit percentage growth in the number of firms whose finances have reached critical condition. Julie Palmer, a partner at Begbie's Traynor, said the tough macroeconomic conditions had created a perfect storm for British businesses. Julie Palmer added, "After a difficult year for British business that was characterized by high interest rates, rampant inflation, weak consumer confidence, and rising and unpredictable input costs, we are now seeing this perfect storm impact every corner of the economy." The Bank of England raised interest rates from 0.1% at the end of 2021 to 5.25% to try to tame inflation. That has significantly increased the cost of borrowing for British businesses, preventing many from papering over the cracks with cheap debt. Julie Palmer, a partner at Begbie's Traynor, said, "Hundreds of thousands of businesses in the United Kingdom who loaded up on affordable debt during those halcyon days are now coming to terms with the added burden this will have on their finances. Sadly, for tens of thousands of British businesses who should be looking ahead with some degree of optimism, the new year will bring a fight for survival." The report found that 539,000 British firms were facing significant financial stress by the end of last year, up by 12.9% in the third quarter of 2023. Most firms facing critical financial distress were based in London and the southeast of England, with the fewest in the northeast and in Northern Ireland. Susanna Streeter, the head of the money and markets at Hargreaves Lansdowne, said, "Last year, the number of firms going bust had already reached the highest level since the great financial crisis of 2008. Susanna Streeter added, "A big chunk of those firms sending up alarm signals are expected to collapse over the next year, adding to expectations that a recession in Britain is imminent." The website of Brexit Carnage has also covered this story and tells us more. New figures showed company insolvencies in the United Kingdom soared last year as businesses struggled with the inflation crisis and the long-term impact of the COVID pandemic. According to CreditSafe, a credit checking agency which tracks 430 million businesses around the world, a total of 30,199 British businesses were involved in some kind of insolvency action in 2023, 52% higher than in previous year 2021. According to Drew Fahia, CreditSafe's data director, some of those insolvencies are likely to have been companies which would have failed earlier but were kept afloat by government help during the COVID pandemic. Drew Fahia said, "For the companies that were doing well, COVID really hurt them, but for the ones that were struggling anyway, it probably gave them a bit of breathing space to get them back where they needed to be. Others are businesses which were thriving until the COVID pandemic. The prop factory had been turning over £800,000 a year and employing 15 people to make and hire out vintage games such as coconut shies and duck shoot galleries for corporate events." Carmen Croxall, the co-founder of the firm, said, "We did Facebook's Christmas party in Dublin. We've worked for Google. We did Renault Formula One's Christmas party." That ground to a halt when the COVID pandemic hit, and in spite of a boost in 2022, when there was a mini boom due to the pent-up demand from customers keen to hold the celebration, they closed the event hire business just before Christmas. Carmen Croxall added, "It never really recovered. This year was 46% down. There was a seismic shift in the industry because people have made cutbacks and we were right at the bottom of the pecking order. The question that remains is whether or not insolvencies will return to pre-pandemic levels soon. CreditSafe tracks whether firms are creditworthy by examining banking data and said that in 2023, British companies paid 45% of all invoices late, up from 35% in 2021 and just over 11 days late on average. Globally, firms in the United States were the slowest to pay, nearly 16 days late on average. According to Stephanie Buckley, who founded the insolvency company with her husband Gareth in 2018 and works with businesses that are shutting down, so far there are no signs that insolvencies are slowing down. She said 2023 had been a record year for their practice. She added, "We see all sorts of reasons for business failures. Grief, baby loss, loss of loved ones, their own health problems. There seem to be a lot more health problems now." She added, "Also, people are struggling to recruit. In a lot of industries, it is hard to find staff, and that has an impact on the business. And costs have gone up with inflation. Those are the main reasons, but everybody we work with cites the COVID pandemic and Brexit." Liz Barclay, the Small Business Commissioner, said that firms had been hit in 2023 by interest rate rises, by inflation rising, business rates and taxes, debt repayments and skills and labour shortages. Liz Barclay added, "This underlines why it's vitally important that all big customers pay their suppliers along the supply chain as quickly as possible. Late payments and extended payment terms add to those businesses' woes and are often the straw that brings vital businesses to their knees. We must make 2024 the year we improve payment practices to help all the firms we deal with to pay and bills, play their part in growing the economy and staying solvent." Tina McKenzie, policy chair at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, "There's always a lag between economic troubles and a rise in the number of insolvencies, as businesses throw everything they have at attempts to keep going before having to call it a day. With growth sluggish at best in 2023, we may well see an impact on small firms' finances this year, even if the economic outlook improves."
Hello everyone, I'm Fataya Masumi and you're watching the fourth episode of CIMOC. Before we get into the events of the festival, I should tell you that throughout its history, many foreign movies have been screened in this festival. Let's take a look.
The International Fajr Film Festival has an impressive record, screening some of the best cinematic works. In the first edition of the Fajr Film Festival, some movies from Eastern Europe and also some from East Asia were screened. In the seventh edition of the Fajr Film Festival, a special section was dedicated to honoring some of the best cinematographers and filmmakers of the world. Also, the category that today we know as Festival of Festivals was added to the event. As of the 16th Fajr Film Festival, the international section became competitive, and foreign movies also received the CIMOC Award. And as of the 23rd edition of the Fajr Film Festival, the different categories were renamed and organized, and the international film market was defined as the most important sideline event.
You might find this interesting, that the international section of the Fajr Film Festival is open to Iranian movies only if they meet the standards. And this year, five Iranian movies have entered the international competition.
Hello
In the main section of the International Fajr Film Festival, dubbed Cinema Salvation, the movie Beautiful Lies, a joint Iranian-Bangladeshi movie, has entered the competition. And its director, Murtaza Atash Zamzam, is hoping that his touching recount of love and sacrifice will bring him a golden Seymour. But the competition is going to be fierce, with two other Iranian movies, The Morning of Execution by Behruz Afkhami and Mahmoud Kalari's Summer Holidays, also in the impressive lineup of movies from countries such as Morocco, Mexico, Venezuela, Spain, Belgium, and France. In the Eastern Vista section dedicated to movies from East Asian Muslim countries, two Iranian movies, namely Hossein Amiri's Zahir and The Western Sky by Mohammad Asghari, have been screened.
Well, it is important to note that there is a huge variety of movies in the international section that have been submitted from different parts of the world. We have movies from China, Malaysia, Bangladesh, India, Japan, and also the Commonwealth of Independent States, including Armenia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. And this obviously makes participating in the Fajr Film Festival a unique experience. Most notably for cinema enthusiasts can enjoy watching movies from countries you really don't get a chance to find movies from. Very different movies, you know? Good movies that you don't come across very often are screened here, so they get to familiarize themselves with a variety of cultures. Take China, for example, and alongside its technological developments, a huge cinema industry has emerged. So China has some very good film directors that are well known around the world, such as Ang Lee, who won an Academy Award for his movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Chiang Kai, another great Chinese director. We have a movie from Japan this year, and Japan is also a country with great cinema. Kurosawa is a prominent Japanese director that we all know. We have movies from India, another country with a huge film industry. If you put Bollywood aside, you come across some great directors, such as Satyajit Ray with an impressive resume, a director that has made many wonderful movies. So I would say that the international section of the Fajr Film Festival is the place to be for all of those movie lovers out there who are looking for something different.
My name is Abid. I'm the founder CEO of Creator Stew. It's a Malaysian company which creates content for Southeast Asia. And I'm very honored to be here at the Fajr Film Festival. This is my first time in Iran, and I'm amazed with the kind of movies being shown and also the kind of content I'm experiencing and you know, watching here.
My film is the second film to compete in this festival. In Malaysia, it's called Imam, but here it transferred to the leader. So It's a story about the two leaders have a different view in the religion. So the first imam, or the first leader, he's trying to bring the new way of thinking.
My name is Andrea Morgan. I'm a festival director and a producer of documentary in Italy. My festival is called Religion Today and has a relationship with Fajr Film Festival since 2000. So it's many, many years of collaboration and partnership. This is my third time here in Iran, in Tehran, at the Fajr Film Festival. And this time I have the honor and the privilege to be a jury member. I can say just the selection is a good selection. The quality, both artistic and technical, is it's very good up to now.
I'm a movie director from China, and this year I have the honor to be a member of the jury. Of course, one of my movies were also screened in the 9 competitive section of the festival too. I have to say that I am impressed by the lineup, and this has turned out to be a great experience.
The International Fajr Film Festival is not just an arena for international movies, but also a platform for foreigners to get to know more about Iranian cinema.
Having the chance to watch some of the best Iranian films that have made it to the festival provides foreign participants with a unique experience and allows them to get to know some great Iranian filmmakers and their cinematic works. According to the foreign participants, even the international film market itself has been a great opportunity to experience everything firsthand, allowing them to familiarize themselves with Iranian films and the recent developments in the industry.
There is something important that you should know about film festivals, and that is the crucial role that movie distributors and producers play in them, particularly the role they play in introducing important films and effectively presenting movie genres and movements to the world. Take the Cannes Festival, for instance. It has been able to gain the status it has today as one of the most important film festivals in the world, mainly because of its film market. It is actually its film market that creates a platform for interaction between filmmakers and producers from all over the world. At the Fajr Festival, also, this get-together of distributors and producers and cinematographers in general makes all the difference. It provides the opportunity for different cultures to meet, and this creates a synergy that allows collaboration leading to the impressive results.
I think it's a very good showcase for the Iranian movie to bring the best of Iranian cinema outside Iran and all around the world. So I'm here also for watching films, to select films to my festival.
The cow of Dariush Mergui. It was quite striking for me when I watched it for the first time. And, you know, the way of storytelling, it captured at once. And, I really love it, Iranian films. And when they are screened during our film festival, the main film festival of Armenia, Golden Apricot, I always try to watch Iranian movies. And probably the last one was the separation of Simin and Nader, yes.
I feel very honored to be here because my favorite Iranian directors, Majidi and Faradi, has been here. So I think that I'm breathing the same air they have been breathing here. So I'm quite privileged, I would say, and I would feel very honored to be in the same space where my favorite directors have been here. And this is a film market and film festival I wanted to come from a very long time. And I think it's quite an honor for me to be here. And I hope one day I'll bring my own films once they are done and screen them here at the film festival. And that's my dream. That's what I'm working towards. And hopefully one day, inshallah, I'll be here with my film.
As a screenwriter, I'm very interested in the way of storytelling of different nations, and I think that Iranian cinema is great just for its way of storytelling. So the Iranian filmmakers found their own way of presenting the situations, telling the stories, and that's what captures the audience. And for me, it's interesting to see how a filmmaker or a scriptwriter can create a huge thing out of tiny little themes.
Your directors in general can speak with the heart to the other people, and so the audience can feel it, also in Italy. So also if the audience is another audience, is different from your country, the ability of your director to speak directly to their hearts is outstanding.
So they will give them more importance for family audience like that also. That is the thing, that is the unique feature of Iranian film. The same thing is followed in India also, by Tamil films also there. They're taking it also there.
I've discovered the Iranian animation. I didn't know that Iran has such a good animation, and the knowledge of this production was probably the main thing I'm bringing back with me to Armenia.
I've been to many film markets before, including Cannes. This is more relatable. Here, the stories which we see are very, I can connect with them. And also, they are more human. So that's the difference between going to a film market in the West and coming to a film market in Iran. So it's that's the kind of difference, and the quality of content is much more human, rather than meet up.
So far we have conducted, by the God's grace, 21 editions. The last December was the 21st edition we have conducted the festival. And we are proud to say each and every edition of Chennai International Film Festival, you used to have Iranian films. It's a must. Minimum 5 films will be there, or maximum 10 films will be there. We'll have an Iranian corner, or glimpses of Iran like that will be screening. And a very good audience are there to witness and enjoy the Iranian film in Chennai.
So I came to Iran in 2022, so I feel up here. So I noticed that the people, the hospitality that I get from the Iranian, the places I went, and the support from the government of Iran, Ministry of Culture and Arts, is so amazing. So that's why the reason I came back for the Iranian film market, because I want to know more about the Iranian film market. I want to share the Iranian film to the people from Southeast Asia, especially Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Brunei. So because this is the market, that Islamic country, that we need to know more about Iran. Because in that part of the world, most of Iran that we know is come from the Western media. So we didn't know what the real story of Iran. So when I come here in 2022, I see the people, I see the city, I see the country, because I've been traveling all over Iran. So it's totally different from what I know, what I see in Malaysia, in media in Malaysia. The program that I've done, actually, it's a travelogue. It's a travel series. I work closely with Iran Embassy in Kuala Lumpur, Iran Ministry of Culture and Arts, Iranian Tourism. So they bring me all over Iran. They introduce me to the culture, to the food, to the history of Iran, to the people of Iran, their hospitality. So this is all we need for me to capture, to bring back to my country, to share with the people. Because until today, if they say about Iran, they don't know much more about Iran. Because it's hardly we see that the Iranian culture or stories in the movies, except from the film. So, and the people I meet along the way is so nice. They invite me to their house, they cook for us, they play music for us, they sing for us, they do craft, a lot of things. So I see that a lot of Iranian people, when we come here with the camera, with the crew, everything, so they invite us, they want to share their culture. They share because we are the same, basically we are the same religion, so they share their history, their stories. So, and also when after we finish shooting, we become friends. When I come back to Malaysia, we still keep in touch in Instagram, Facebook. So sometimes some of them come to our country and we bring them. In return, we show to them, this is our country. So that's how I see, and that's how I want to share about my experience in Iran.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
History is going to be a much harsher judge of those political leaders who justified and tolerated the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing in Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, "For the last 4 months, the West has watched Gaza being demolished block by block. Residential districts have been razed, universities, hospitals, libraries blown up. Families which form the pillars of society have been exterminated in their homes where they gathered en masse. The ranks of the middle class, doctors, journalists, academics, businessmen, decimated. Aid convoys have been bombed. The hungry, queuing for food, or those simply trying to flee on foot, executed by snipers. These scenes of devastation are reminiscent of worse crimes of the Second World War. Rafah, which has become the last refuge, is set to become the next target. And yet 4 months on, this industrial-scale operation has no difficulty in finding backers among those who identify themselves as liberals." Biden and Starmer's insouciance about the dangers that supporting the Zionist regime's campaign in Gaza could create for them is bizarre, because each man prizes power above principle. They're shameless promise breakers. One might have expected them to be more cautious before following the Zionist regime down the path of historical ignominy. Because every day this war continues, Netanyahu is looking less and less like the man to put your money on. The Zionist regime's campaign in Gaza is becoming an electoral liability precisely because it is now in its fifth month and shows no sign of stopping. A poll released recently showed a dramatic fall in support for Labour from British Muslims. Data collected by Servation, commissioned by the Labour Muslim Network, LMN, showed that 60% of British Muslims who expressed a preference for a party said they would vote Labour. That reappears a drop of 26% of Muslims precisely polled in 2019. Only 43% said they would definitely vote Labour again, with 23% undecided. Identification with Labour is down from 72% in 2021 to 49% in 2024, with 38% of British Muslims stating they had a more unfavorable view of the Labour Party following the past 12 months. Starmer's personal rating is 11%. Support for Labour among Muslims has been steadily declining since the 2019 election, but the turning point into rapid decline came in November, a month into the Gaza war. In 4 months, support for the party has plummeted from 70 to 40%. Starmer's instinct has been to double down. Shortly after his LBC debacle, he warned all elected representatives not to attend ceasefire protest. When the Starmer's refusal to call for a ceasefire was put to a vote, several members of his shadow cabinet resigned. Since then, more than 70 Labour councillors have resigned in areas like Oxford, Burnley, Hastings and Norwich. Resignations and expulsions of the anti-Zionists left from the party are now producing a blowback. The marginal seats of the two frontbenchers, Wes String, the Shadow Health Secretary, and Roshana Ali, Shadow Minister for Investment, are threatened, as well as the seats of John Ashworth in Leicester and in late Tony Lloyd Rockdale seat, where a by-election is happening later this month. They could all be flipped by a Muslim vote, which is greater than the Labour majority. 36 other seats, including that of Margaret Hodge, who called the previous Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, anti-Semitic and racist, could be turned into marginals. Grassroots groups are shooting up all over the place with thousands of volunteers ready to support independent candidates. One group called the Muslim Vote, TMV, said that it will support independent candidates with resources, networks, volunteers and funding in constituencies where it thinks it has an audience. An independent candidate could well stand in Starmer's own constituency. A young British-Palestinian candidate, Lean Mohammed, has already been found to challenge streeting in Ilford North. The Rajbridge Community Action Group, who proposed her, vowed to put forward a candidate that would be strong on Palestine, NHS, racism, Islamophobia and the cost of living crisis. This represents a potent fusion of Gaza and the agenda of the pre-Starmer Labour Party, all of which highly ambitious apparat hikes like streeting are vulnerable on. Streeting himself is conscious of the danger he is in and has started mouthing platitudes about the importance of a Palestinian state. No one is under any illusion that the Muslim vote could stop Starmer coming to power, but it could make the difference between a Blair-style landslide and a minority government. And Biden. Biden is most vulnerable in Michigan. When faced with the mounting anger of a substantial Arab and Muslim population, the response of his campaign team was very similar to Starmer's, to write Arabs off and find other paths to victory. As Politico reported, Biden's support for Israel has hurt the campaign badly with the sizable Arab American population in Michigan, and his team is scrambling to find other paths to victory in the battleground state, according to two campaign advisors granted anonymity because they aren't authorized to speak publicly about a strategy. Dearborn has the highest concentration of Arab Americans. It has become the epicenter of a national campaign against Biden's re-election. As night follows day, an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal dubbed Dearborn as America's capital. The local police presence has been ramped up as a result. We can expect the same smears to start appearing in the British right-wing media. Activists from Michigan, Minnesota, Arizona, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania have created and abandoned Biden campaign, six of them battleground states. Abandon Biden even if the victor of that campaign should be Donald Trump, the nemesis of Muslims? Well, apparently yes. A new generation is on the march to change the face of the Democratic Party permanently. Gilani Hussein, director of Minnesota's Council on American Islamic Relations chapter, said in Dearborn, Michigan, when asked about alternatives to Biden, "We don't have two options. We have many options. U.S. Muslims don't expect to be treated better than the disdain. Disrespect is a better word. They are getting under Biden. But if Biden is reelected, the vote in November is their only chance to reshape U.S. policy. Biden won Michigan by 2.8 percent points, and Arabs account for 5% of the vote. Dearborn's first Arab mayor, Abdullah Hamoud, is extremely clear about what he wants Biden to do. There has never been a war in history in which 80% of the country is absolutely decimated, where 100% of the population has been displaced, and where 50% of all deaths are children. That has never happened. For us, we want action, not lip service. If President Biden wants to take a firm stance, he can begin by restricting military aid to Israel. He could begin by calling for a ceasefire because right now, nearly 200 civilians are killed each day and every single day. These are tangible steps that can be taken because of what we understand is only diplomatic efforts can lead to lasting peace and justice." He said, "We can be sure of one thing. History is going to be a much harsher judge of those political leaders who justified and tolerated the ethnic cleansing now going on in the Gaza Strip."
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Subjects on divine issues and mythical issues are easy, and each person thinks he has understood them. After the rise of logical reasoning and following it, reaching the inferences of these subjects and the results of the logical reasoning to the heart, which is called faith, is more difficult. This subject must reach the heart with prompting, repetitions, and self-abstinence. You notice that as necessitated, a deceased person does not inflict any loss to a person except some persons. Others, if they are alone in a graveyard and they are confronted with the body of a dead person in a mortuary, they are overcome with fear. This is because the logical reasoning and mental necessity has not reached the heart.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. On the subject of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "We brought a novel experience. We adopted democracy from religion. Our democracy is accompanied by spirituality and religion. Hence, it became religious popular rule. It became the Islamic Republic." One of the factors for the Iranian people's uprising against the regime of Mohammad Reza, it became the Islamic Republic. Well, this sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is about the nobleness of the revolution in Iran. The regime of Shah was opposite to Islamic culture and values and tried to promote morality in society. The Islamic Revolution put an end to this evil situation, and the promotion and propagation of religion replaced it.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
sallallahu alayhi
salli
The religiosity and spirituality of the revolution is so important that Ayatollah Khamenei Hafizahullah said, "The message of the Islamic revolution is the message of spirituality, attention to spirituality and bringing the elements of spirituality in human life and heeding of morality and God." During four decades, ample activities have been done for expansion of the Islamic culture. Mosques have played such an important role in this regard that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh called mosques as the trenches of the revolution. The quantity and quality of religious ceremonies have increased as well. The morning ceremonies of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and other imams of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam are held very gloriously and fervently. Along with that, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, many efforts have been made to promote lofty teachings of the Holy Book of Quran across the country. Presently, 11,000 institutions related with Quran are active in cities and villages, offering a variety of Quranic teachings to different age groups. Moreover, 35 rounds of international competitions of Quran have been held in Iran in different fields. These competitions are considered the most valid and important Quranic events in the world. And that is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh focused on this issue and introduced the nobleness of the revolution in Iran as one of its main characteristics. May Allah bless his soul.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The Limelight.
The Al-Aqsa storm operation has irreversibly redefined the battlefield dynamics, especially with the Palestinian resistance stunning the military pundits in the West with its preparedness and the ability to inflict heavy and irreparable blows to the occupying Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted the past 15 weeks have been marked by the Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime genocidal aggression on the Gaza Strip, with the armed wing of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas surprising all and sundry with its massive weapons arsenal, all of them locally manufactured. Toward the end of 2023, the martyr Azzeddin Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, published a video showing its missile arsenal that is able to reach every nook and corner of the occupied territories. Military experts in the West acknowledge that the Israeli regime, with all its advanced and sophisticated weapon systems imported from the United States and Europe, has been unable to match up to the armed wings of the Palestinian resistance groups and their fighters. Despite the Zionist regime dropping 67,000 tons of bombs on Gaza since October 7th, the resistance continues to grow and inflict heavy blows on the structure of the Zionist occupation. The story of the Palestinian missile program is a story of decades of sacrifice, ingenuity, dedicated work, and successful management, and above all, the defiant spirit of resistance. This long and difficult path of resistance against the apartheid regime began with Palestinian stone throwing at Israeli armored vehicles during two intifadas, and ended with the capability to launch 5,000 rockets in one day and a rocket arsenal sufficient for months of warfare. The missile capabilities and scope of operations displayed by the Hamas and other Palestinian groups surprised all international observers, even the Zionist intelligence services. What is particularly intriguing are the conditions in which the operation was carried out. Pertinently, the Gaza Strip was under Israeli occupation from 1967 to 2005, and ever since has been under a fierce land, sea, and air blockade that prevents the import of not only weapons, but also materials for their production as well as basic goods. The Zionist regime tried everything to weaken the resistance and retain the military technological advantage so that it could easily eliminate the groups that have been fighting for the liberation of Palestine. An example that illustrates this disparity is the Gaza massacre of 15 years ago, when hundreds of Palestinian civilians were killed by the Zionist regime's bombs. Hundreds of Israeli civilians, the so-called war tourists, gathered on the nearby hills and cheered triumphantly. However, times have changed since that gruesome, bloodthirsty cheering by the Zionist settlers that was followed by the iconic photo of a Palestinian boy throwing a rock at an Israeli tank. The Palestinian resistance initially relied on rudimentary weapons, smuggled or domestically produced, intended for close combat and countering invading forces on their soil. After years of usage of assault rifles and explosives, a simple Qassam rocket appeared in 2001, with a range of a handful of kilometers and low destructive power, which for the first time made possible a retaliatory strike against the Israeli occupation. Over time, the efficiency of the Qassam models increased, and the first Israeli military bases and occupied cities came within range in 2010s, which caused the phenomenon of war tourists on the borders of Gaza to fall into oblivion suddenly. The Zionist regime made an effort to stop the effectiveness of these rocket attacks